Chapter 5, verse 1 to 3, opens with a text that you know because it's quoted in Matthew's Gospel. "And you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, who are one of the little clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to rule in Israel." Scholars are not over clear about this. So Ephrathah is possibly the people in Bethlehem, the suggestion is, belong to the clan of Ephrathah, a clan group, just as in Scotland you've got clan groups all over the place, and Ireland, I guess, too. So Bethlehem Ephrathah, I'll go back to the first book of Samuel, chapter 17, verse 2, where it talks about Yahweh restoring Zion by raising up a new David, and David is described as the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah. So David belonged to the clan of Ephrathah and lived in Bethlehem. So that's the reference. Another interesting thing just in that first two lines might be that if you look up the quote in Matthew 2 to 6, he changes it. You are not one of the least. So their ability to, they're not concerned with giving an absolutely right interpretation of Micah. You can't put "not" in if you're doing that. But he's trying to make connections in that first two chapters of Matthew and throughout. He's trying to make as many connections as he can between Jesus' life and the spirituality and the of their past. The show that Jesus was actually not only not a renegade, which he was declared to be by the high priest and crucified because of that. He wasn't only not that, he's actually the one who fulfills all our dreams, even the dreams of Micah back there in this reference in chapter 5. So he says, yeah, Micah was talking about, but really we know that it wasn't one of the least because Jesus came out of it, do you see? So that's all right. I mean, as long as you know what you're doing, it's fine. So back now to our text. "You, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, who are one of the little clans of Judah, from you will come forth for me one who is to rule in Israel." You'll also recall that David was the youngest son. It's like from rags to riches. It's the poor that God raises up. The prophet had done all the boys of the family, which surely one of them is going to be the one. No, have you got another one? Oh, we've got a little lad out there looking after the sheep because, you know, oh, bring him in. He's the one. So God's choice, God has what did Paul say? God has chosen the weak of this world to confound the strong, etc. "His origins are from antiquity, from olden days, this one that is going to come forth, this new David. Therefore, he shall..." Now, there's a misprint here and in my book. I apologize for it. It slipped through. "He shall give them up," is what it should have, not "give them." He'll give them up or give them over, or the Jewish Publication Society, their English translation says, he'll leave them in their helpless state. So it's the idea of he'll give them up till something happens. "Therefore, he shall give them over until the time when she who is in labour has brought forth." And in the New Testament, you can see the link they would make there with Mary, of course. "Then the rest of his kindred will return to the people of Israel. He shall stand and shepherd them in the strength of Yahweh, in the majesty of the name of Yahweh his God, and they shall live secure. For now he will be great to the ends of the earth." So having promised that the sword will become a plowshare and so on, and peace will be established, the one who's going to bring it about is the one. This is the messianic dream that starts here, really, and that grows and grows, and it becomes more important, the messianic dream, when there's no king. They kept hoping the next king would be the Messiah, the son of the king, the prince, Hezekiah, is he going to be the Messiah? You know, etc., etc. When there's no king left, it becomes a long-range trust, hope. They're still living by it. I remember when I was in Jerusalem a heck of a long time ago, talking to a dear rabbi that was there in the somewhere where I was. I can't remember exactly. I can see his face, but I can't remember the situation. And I said, it was in the temple, that's right, somewhere, or in the mosque or somewhere there. And I said to him, are the Jews, how do you feel about having a mosque over the temple site? He said, we're quite happy for that to be the case. I said, would you ever build a temple again? He said, oh no. He said, only the Messiah can build the temple. So that's their view. So the Messiah is still coming, and the Messiah, no one else can do it. So in the meantime, it's a sacred site. It's not being trampled on. It's not being used. So they're it's okay. So because they can't build a temple, they're still waiting for this one, the promised one, to come. Okay. And he, this Messiah, this anointed one, he will be the one of peace. When Assyria invades our land, which is looking highly likely, it's already invaded the north, and overruns our citadels, we will raise against him 7 shepherds. 8. They often do that. 7, 8. You know, 7's perfect. What more? Just extra. 8 military commanders. They will shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword. And the land of Nimrod, that's over in Iraq, with the drawn sword. He will save us from Assyria when he invades our land and when he treads within our border. Then, for the remnant of Jacob, surrounded by many peoples, he will be like dew from Yahweh, this promised one, like showers on the grass, which do not depend upon people or wait for any human intervention. This is a gift from God, in other words. For the remnant of Jacob among the nations, surrounded by many peoples, he will be like a lion. Lion of Judah, the symbol of Judah. Because there were lions down in the Araba, down next to the Jordan River. He will be like a lion among the animals of the forest, like a young lion among the flocks of sheep, which when it goes through, treads down and tears to pieces with no one to deliver. Your hand shall be lifted up over your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off. And it will happen in that day, says Yahweh, I will cut off your horses from among you, I will destroy your chariots, I'll cut off the cities of your land and throw down all your strongholds, and I will cut off the instruments of magic from your hand, and you will have no more sorcerers. I will cut off your images and your pillars, the Asherah pillars, from among you, and you will bow down no more. Here's the key line. You'll bow down no more to the work of your hands. We human beings, can happen to any of us at any time, worshipping what we've done. You know, what we've done. And I will uproot your sacred poles from among you and destroy your cities. And in anger and wrath, I will execute vengeance on the nations that did not obey. O my people, this comes into the Holy Week. O my people, what have I done to you? In what have I wearied you? Like, why are you so slow to listen? You know, Jesus had a similar cry. So, answer me. And then he reminds them, the prophet, of course. I brought you from the land of Egypt. I took you out of slavery. And here you are going back into slavery. Slave to your own hand, what you've built, what your own. I redeemed you from the house of slavery. I sent before you Moses and Aaron and Miriam. Oh, my people, remember how what King Balak of Moab devised and how Balaam, son of Beor, answered him. Balak was the king of Moab, and he looked everywhere for the most famous prophet. and that was Balaam, and he got him over to curse. This is the story. Of course, it's a story. Got him over to curse the Israelites. And Balaam went around and he had all kinds of bits of kind of working out what was going on. Then he went out, and when he started to talk, he intended to curse them, but out came this blessing about the star will rise, and was all, you know, and the king said, "I cut it out, I didn't pay you to do that." And then so Balaam comes out of the book of Numbers, it is chapter 24, 5, 6, I think. Yeah. No, 22, 3, 4. It's a little section there. Balaam comes out of that pretty good. He seems a pretty good bloke if you read that. If you read anything else in the Old Testament scripture, Balaam was a real crook, and he got murdered and hacked around. And so who was this Balaam? Probably a legendary figure, but whatever he was, there are different opinions about him. In any case, this is saying, remember that. When the king was determined to have you curse, Balaam praised you and all that. And remember what happened from Shittim, which was the last. Shittim means some kind of a tree. It's just escaped me at the moment. It's a tree. And it's a forest of trees on the other side of the Jordan, the east side. And that was their last camp. And when they... Gilgal was the first place they stopped on the west side of the Jordan. And so between Shittim and Gilgal, they crossed the Jordan River dry shod, which is possibly the image behind the story of the crossing of the Red Sea. It's all connected in here. That you may know the saving acts of Yahweh. So why are you doing this? Why are you misbehaving? Why are you missing your dream? Why are you getting caught up in all this stuff? Remember what I've done for you, and know how you've been saved and loved, and obviously change your behaviour. And then we come to a famous passage which needs a bit of care. With what shall I come before Yahweh? If I'm going to repent, well, what will I do? What do we do? What do we do to get eternal life? The rich young man's question. With what shall I come and bow down before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings of year-old calves? That's what the priests were saying was important. And it wasn't without meaning, but that's... Will Yahweh be pleased with thousands of rams? Should we add to the sacrifices? With 10,000 rivers of oil? These are the cultic things. Is cult the answer? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression? Shall I do what the Moabites and other people do? Give up your child? Sacrifice your child to God? Like Abraham thought he should do, remember, with Isaac? Till the story is, of course, all about saying you can't do that. God doesn't want that done. Shall I give the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? And then here comes the answer, Micah's answer, which you've heard. It's very rich. He has told you, man, and I didn't know what to put there because English is such a troublesome language, but I've put it's Adam, so it's not male, it's human being. Oh, human being, I've told you what is good. What is Yahweh seeking from you? And this is what he's seeking. To do justice. Asa asot. That's the infinitive of the Hebrew. Asa is to do. So it's about what you do, not pious thoughts alone. So do something. And what you've got to do, mishpat is hard to prove. Justice is all right, but it's too vague for it, really. Mishpat is basically when you're in a courtroom and the one responsible for handing down the judgment hands down a judgment that is correct, just, right, and conducive to good. Like, it's a proper exercise of justice. So mishpat is the exercise of justice by judgments that are made in accordance with the truth. I put it pretty well there. I wish I could write that down somewhere. Anyhow, that's about it. That's the essence of mishpat. So do it. Make your judgments correct. And judgments, of course, is the judgment is what leads to action. It's not It's about what you do. The second thing to do is, I've translated it, be committed to the covenant. Now, that's my translation, but here's the words. Ahav in Hebrew means love. Love. Now, it's the ordinary word for love. But love always... No, it doesn't. It's not true. It has a whole range of meanings, but basically it means to choose. You remember Jacob loved Rachel and hated, it says in the thing, Leah. So love and hate. Unless you remember, didn't Jesus say, unless you hate your mother and father and sisters, that funny text in Luke, which is correctly translated straight from the Aramaic, but it doesn't mean hate your mother. It means choose first something. It means don't make that your first choice, because if that's your first choice, you're not going to love her very well. The first love, love the Lord your God with all your heart. So in other words, let Jesus get to the sacred, love another person for their inner beauty and the fact that they are a gift from God and that they are essentially sacred. If that's your focus, then you'll love them very well. But if you love them without this, you won't love them very well at all. You might desire them and you might be emotionally attached to them, etc. But you won't really love them because you won't recognize their sacred being. So I've said a lot there too quickly. So, but there's the word. So love... Now, chesed is the word you meet a lot in hymns and things around the place, I imagine. Chesed, again, big word. And I think the basic meaning is it's a commitment. It's a covenant made between husband and wife, for example, a covenant that's made. So to love chesed means to be committed to the covenant. Well, in this case, the covenant is with God. That's the prior. So respond to the covenant that God has made with you. He's talked about it already. God's faithful to it. So you be faithful to it. Open yourself to it. Trust it. Believe it. But act accordingly, according to that covenant. And finally, and this is a bit hard to translate too, because the word here occurs, I think, only three times in the Bible. So it's and then all the other... cognate languages of that period don't help a lot either. So here you've got that's to walk. Im is with Elohim, Eloheka, your God. So walk with your God is very clear in the Hebrew. What's the meaning of this verb here? Tsana. I think it means... My best translation would be what I've put there, mindfully. Walk humbly, it says, doesn't it? Humbly is quite a good translation, but let's get what I think the essence of the verb in Hebrew is, know yourself, know your limitations, know that everything that you have is a gift from God, and knowing that, walk with God. Don't just do it on your own, don't be your own, I'll do it my way or whatever. So humbly can come in, though the word itself doesn't technically mean humble. Live your life, live a reflective life. Live it mindfully, but particularly mindful of who you are as a creature of God, as a gift of God, you exist because of God. Knowing that, you'll walk humbly, I guess you could say, with your God. So to take it without all that talk again, this is what you've got to do, says Micah. This is the essence of religious behaviour. Do what you know to be true, what is true. So you've got to seek the truth and then judge according to the truth, not the way you'd like things to be or wish they were, but living the whole reality of your life, search for the truth, and in searching for the truth, make decisions based on what you've discovered. That's what it's saying there. And be committed yourself to the covenant that God has made with you. That's quite beautiful, really, quite profound. And as walk with God, as that hymn, that song, I Walk With God, from this, you probably all know it. Walk with God mindfully of who you are, what the earth is. Be know yourself and walk, not what other people tell you to do and all that, though that's not irrelevant to it, but ultimately we've got to walk alone and walk our journey truthfully. The voice of Yahweh, he is calling to the city. Are there the treasuries of wickedness in the house of the wicked, and the fraudulent ephah, the weighing, this is injustice again, in the detested city? Can I tolerate wicked scales and a bag of dishonest weights? Amos revisited. You wealthy are full of violence, your inhabitants speak lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouths. Woe is me. I have become like one who, after the summer fruit has been gathered, after the vintage has been gleaned, finds nothing to eat. You know how they had the rule, you may know, when you went through on the vintage, you didn't go back a second time. Say I owned the vineyard or the apple orchard or the wheat. You go through and do your harvesting, but you don't go back and clean it all up. You leave that there for the gleaners, the people, the poor, and that was one little bit of social justice in the system where other people could come in and, okay. Well, he's like one who goes through after it's all happened and there's nothing to get. There's no first ripe fig for which I hunger. The faithful have disappeared from the land. There's no one left, says poor Micah, who is upright. I don't know how Isaiah would have taken that if he heard it, but okay. Basically, they are all lie in wait for blood, and they hunt each other with nets. Their hands are skilled to do evil. The official and the judge ask for a bribe. The powerful dictate what they desire. Thus they pervert justice. The best of them is like a briar. The most upright of them is a thorn hedge. The day of their sentinels, of their punishment has come. Now their confusion is at hand. Put no trust in a friend. Have no confidence in a loved one. Guard the doors of your mouth from her who lies in your embrace. Don't even whisper things to your wife, because it's getting around. You know, I mean, at times in our world where you just got to be quiet, you know. He's saying don't trust anybody, because the word will get back and you'll be in trouble. For the son treats the father with contempt. Do you remember this text? The daughter rises up against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Your enemies are members of your own household. So it's a time of distrust. No one can you be sure of who to trust. I imagine it would have been like this in England, for example, when the priests went over to Belgium to be trained at the time of the Reformation and came back to say Mass for the, and they had to be, no one, it had to be mum, had to, you couldn't say anything to anybody. And when they, most of them were martyred within a year or less of their coming back. But that's the kind of situation, and he's saying that's the situation there in there at this time in Judah. And Jesus is saying it's like that in his day too. People have to decide, and even family isn't a safe place to be. As for me, and I think he's speaking on behalf of Zion here, as for me, I will watch for Yahweh. So things are grim all around him, but I'll watch for Yahweh. I'll wait for the God of my salvation. Don't rejoice over me, O my enemy. Although I fell, I got up again. When I will sit in darkness, Yahweh will be a light for me. I must bear the indignation of Yahweh because I have sinned against him, until he concludes his case against me and completes my punishment. He will bring me out to the light. I will see his justice. So he's interpreting and accepting, and this is the beginning of this, but it's that, okay, there was a general idea around, and you'll find stacks of this in the Bible too, and it's too simplistic to be true, you know, if you're, God will reward the good with success and money and the rest of it, and the bad not. Well, that doesn't add up to too much investigation. So he's aware of that too. So he's somehow taking that the adversity that he's going through and the difficult times, yes, they are. He's accepting that he's a sinner too, because God must be doing it to him because of his sin. That's the logic. Not true, but that's what the... So he's confessing his own weakness and sinfulness, but he's trusting that ultimately God's love will prevail for him. Then my enemy will see, and shame will cover her who said to me, "Where is Yahweh your God?" My eyes will see her downfall, her, probably the city. Now she will be trodden down like the mire of the streets, a day for the rebuilding of your walls. In that day the boundary shall be far extended. In that day, the day of the dream and the hope, they will come to you from Assyria and Egypt, and from Egypt as far as the river, from sea to sea, and from the mountain to the mountain. "Who is a God like you?" they will say, "pardoning iniquity, passing over the treachery of the remnant of your possession, who does not retain his anger forever? Because he delights, God, in showing clemency. He will again have," chesed is the Hebrew, compassion, it's translated there. "He will again have a faithful covenant upon us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. You will cast all your sins into the depth of the sea. You will show faithfulness to Jacob, unswerving loyalty," another way of translating chesed, "to Abraham, as you have sworn to our ancestors from the days of old."